Let's now head to Belfast, Northern Ireland, and welcome Quinton Oliver. He's the founder, director of Stratagem, which was established almost 20 years ago following the Good Friday Belfast Agreement, when he led the Yes campaign. Firstly, let me welcome you, Quinton. How are you doing?
Very well, Adrian. Good afternoon from Belfast.
Now, the challenges that you and your company have undertaken over the last now almost 20 years, I have to assume that you're busy these days, and acknowledge friends, that through the years, when we've wanted a non-biased opinion on what is happening in Northern Ireland, we do reach out to you, Quinton, as a regular contributor to our program, and obviously we're very happy about that. We're getting confused, as I'm sure many others are, with respect to a number of situations in Northern Ireland which seem like they're kind of going from the frying pan into the fire. And up, you know, on the top of that list is the confusion with respect to the UK, the European Union, Britain pulling out of the European Union, and the threat of the restoration of an Irish border, the border between Northern Ireland and the South. Maybe you can give us perhaps an overall view and try to give us something we'd like to hear on the threat of, the border coming back.
Yes, indeed. These are worrying times. It reminds me of the 2 years of negotiations that led to the Good Friday Belfast Agreement, and particularly the last 2 weeks when finally everyone got serious. You remember George Mitchell was nominated by President Clinton to chair those talks, and he was getting frustrated over the 2 years. They were lengthy and tedious, and then finally the last 2 weeks began to hot up. And that's the situation we're in now, that this European summit in 10 days is going to be critical, because it will decide whether or not to tick off the top three issues that were on the agenda. The first was the right of European citizens in other countries, post-Brexit, British citizens in other European countries, and vice versa. And they seem to have got an agreement on that. The second was what's called the divorce bill. How much would the UK pay into Europe as it left that club? And it seems to be about £40 to £50 billion has been agreed. But the third is the most controversial, and that's the question of the Irish border. And Ireland's diplomats had done a remarkable feat of getting that up there in the top three issues. But it's the one that remains a thorny one. And that's why the next 10 days are critical, because everyone on this island has enjoyed the benefits of an open border for the last 20 years. And that was one of the remarkable consequences of the Belfast Agreement, that we could agree to be Irish or British or both, that we would have strong north-south relations, there would be no border, there would be trade, there would be students' exchanges, there would be youth groups crisscrossing the island without any delays. And there would be strong east-west relations between the two islands. And that was recognised by the visit of Queen Elizabeth to Ireland a couple of years ago. And overall, there's massive reduction in violence. So in 1998, we killed 100 people, I think, in the conflict for political reasons. And now that has almost been removed. It's down to one or two people. So how do we solve the border question if the British are intent on leaving, and Europe has to control and patrol its borders, but everyone here on this island says we enjoy that those freedoms. So there are some technological solutions, as on motorway toll roads, where your license plate on your car is picked up and you're then sent a bill if you haven't paid it. That's one possible solution, although how do you see what's inside a lorry? How do you see whether the lorry has people being smuggled or it's goods that should be paying a tariff? So the technology is one possible solution, but not the whole one. And then there are trusted trader schemes. I understand that's familiar on the American-Mexico border, where yes, there'll be fast-tracking on the roads for trusted traders or for very small businesses. But we haven't quite seen a resolution. And that's why the Irish government are saying they want a written promise from the British government. And the British government is saying, well, we need to work out the trade deal, and then we can see what border mechanisms we need. So the next 10 days are going to be really interesting to see whether both sides can tick the three issues, and the last one's the most important, the Irish border, in order to proceed then to the wider trade talks.
You know, far be it from, you know, from us to cast aspersions on negotiations, because there have been meetings, a half a dozen of them at least already, and so this one is, you know, this one has an end date. It has, this is it. The one coming up is it, or is it going to be like, you know, several other deadlines that come and go and are stretched? What's your view on this?
Well, this is a gateway to the bigger talks, and this is all set out legally. The Article 50 was the clause that the British government had to trigger to indicate its intent to leave the European Union. That triggered 2 years of talks, and the first phase is now coming to an end in 10 days. If both sides agree that sufficient progress has been made, if not, then it will be delayed, but that banks up a bigger problem, because the wider talks about the trade arrangements are going to be massively more complicated. I mean, the border issue is politically complex, but technically probably less so. But the bigger issue is the relationship of the UK to the rest of the European Union in trade terms. And that's where there's some worry, because Ireland is very prominent in the 27, and President Donald Tusk, who's president of the 27 EU countries, the European Council, said on Friday that if Ireland wasn't happy, then the rest of the EU wasn't happy. So he gave Ireland the right to make this decision. But Ireland is only 1% of the European Union in numerical terms. It's 5 million people out of 500 million. And Northern Ireland is only 2.5% of the UK. So both the motherships, if you can view it like that, have got small numerical but big political issues to deal with. And so Ireland will be wanting to play that key role within the 27, and Northern Ireland will want to play a key role within the UK decisions, and that's where the DUP are in a particularly close relationship with the Conservative government. And neither side wants to be sold out by its parent body.
Right.
That those are possibilities, and there will be concerns that the small fry on this island will be let go hang if the bigger issues of trade and economy and nationality and sovereignty are deemed by London or by the EU 27 to require such a sacrifice. So that is a worry for everyone on this island.
How would you describe the clout of the DUP right now, you know, threatening to pull support from Theresa May's government if she backs down on the post-Brexit Irish border issue? Is first of all, Is that a for real, or is that, is that another, red herring that's been thrown out there for the moment?
Yes, that's what we're all trying to interpret. I remember in the week leading up to the Good Friday Agreement on the Monday, John Taylor, who was then deputy leader of the larger Unionist Party, then the Ulster Unionist Party, mm-hmm. Trimble's deputy, he said he wouldn't touch the draft Good Friday Agreement with a 40-foot pole. And that was newspaper headlines, Unionists about to withdraw indeed. From agreement, no chance of agreement and so forth. And that came to my mind yesterday when Sammy Wilson of the DUP said they would withdraw their 10 votes from supporting Theresa May's Conservative government. Was that a big bluff in order to secure further concessions? Or is it a real threat? And are they really so upset at the possibility of Northern Ireland being treated slightly differently from the rest of the United Kingdom that they would pull the whole government down? Now, those are classic symptoms of the intensity of negotiation. People will always try and say that they're in a strong position. They'll always try and extract a further concession. They'll always threaten to walk out. And that shows how existential these discussions are. They're existential for Northern Unionism, and it's existential for nationalism on the island as well. So that's why the stakes are incredibly high.
Now, and my guest friends is Quinton Oliver and his company Stratagem, again involved for the last 20 years in not only in negotiations in Northern Ireland, but tell us a bit about your own company and what. And what it is you do.
Yes, we set it up after the referendum in 1998 on the Good Friday Agreement. We ran the Yes campaign in that to persuade people to vote for it. And we set it up in the public policy space. So we want to help people doing their work in business and non-profit organisations and single-issue campaigns to help them connect with the political structures, with legislative change, with regulatory frameworks so that they can do what they want to do better, easier, faster. And also we work internationally because there's a great excitement around the world about the peaceful transition from conflict, the conflict that had killed nearly 4,000 people. And so we offer the insights and experiences of how we did that to other conflicts around the world. So those are the twin parts of our business, domestically helping participatory democracy here in Northern Ireland and internationally on conflict resolution and how things can be improved in other conflicts.
Is it naive to think that somewhere there is a possibility of, and again, it came to mind when you were talking about the DUP and if they were to, tear down Theresa May's government. Is it naive to think that perhaps if Britain went back to the polling booth and the voting, that the result might be different second time around?
Well, that's interesting because the polls say that there's been very little shift on Brexit. And sometimes you do get a voter's remorse where the voter thinks, oh, maybe I was a bit foolish or naive, maybe too greedy in hoping things would get better. But the polls actually show maybe just a statistical margin, 4 or 5 percentage point change towards remaining, but that's almost insignificant and there's no campaign on it, so people could be persuaded still to vote for Brexit. But I think more potentially compelling is the weakness of the Conservative government. So if there were a general election in the UK, would there be a shift away from the Conservatives supported by the 10 DUP votes back towards Labour and the Liberal Democrats? Now, that's an interesting question. And the second question flowing from that, if you were to get a Labour government, perhaps supported by the Scottish Nationalists or the Liberal Democrats, would they try to reverse the Brexit decision? And I think they're probably also split on it. The Conservatives have held themselves towards Brexit because that people's vote surmounted their internal divisions. So Theresa May herself was a Remainer, but is prosecuting the Brexit case. So would a Labour government shift that? Who knows?
Yeah. If the polls show that that sense what many feel was perhaps a rushed decision because of the unease of the British citizenry, one would have to be a huge shift, between now and the general election. Would a general election would that change the goalposts?
It probably would, yes, because the Brexit vote was a narrow one. It was 52%. So that was a narrow move to Brexit. And the Conservative government at their snap election in June was a narrow victory, only consolidated by the extra 10 DUP votes. So it could shift the other way in both respects if there were a mood change. And the circumstances of what would cause the election would be part of that narrative. And that's less so in Ireland, where the coalition, the minority coalition government of Leo Varadkar, if it were to move to an election, and they averted one last week over the resignation of the Taoiseach, indeed. But that wouldn't shift the position on Brexit. It might change the Irish government. But they are clearly, quite rightly, defending their national interests alongside their allies in the 27 European countries. And for once, it is interesting that Ireland perhaps has more clout than Britain. And that's a delicious irony for those of us who know our history and know the colonial relationship between the two. So now the smaller country, Ireland, and its independence, teaming up with its allies in the European Union, is actually putting massive pressure on the former colonial power, Britain, in the Brexit negotiations.
What was, let's just focus on Northern Ireland and the outcome of their vote on Brexit. How did that compare, say, with the rest of Britain?
Yes, we voted to remain here, but fairly narrowly. It's 56% to remain. So Scotland was 62% to remain. And we were 56% to remain. So clearly we did vote to remain, but it wasn't massive. It was 56-44. But the key to that is that the DUP were on the Brexit side, and they hold a powerful relationship with the Conservatives in London. So that's one aspect. And you'll remember that when the late Martin McGuinness resigned in January of this year and brought down the Northern Ireland executive, Sinn Féin and the DUP have failed to negotiate themselves back into the Northern Ireland government at Stormont. But if they were in power, they would be prosecuting polar opposite positions on Brexit. So nationalism and republicanism would be strongly in favour of remaining, of staying in the customs union, staying in the single market and no border, whereas the DUP, because of their existential relationship to the union with Westminster and with London, won't countenance any softening of that position, and they don't want the border to be shifted from a land border on the island to a stronger barrier between the two islands, because that obviously undermines their concept of union between Northern Ireland and Great Britain.
Quinton, there appears to be at least some degree of, we wouldn't call it pessimism, but there are those who feel that perhaps the peace process and a definition of a border, which we that has to be even ironed out yet, whether it's a hard border or a soft border, but it would, to have some aspects, free travel, unrestricted travel from north to south. I know you've pointed out before, you know, what's in the lorry when it crosses the border, but how much is, say, the north-south relationship, what are there degrees, are there priorities, and would, again, not only for tourists, but for people who live in or near the border and who have to cross there every day for work or for whatever, is there going to be cherry-picking and a list of priorities at these negotiations, saying, well, for openers, we want to make sure that whatever about trade, that there is free access, free travel in the north, and how can that be achieved?
Yes, there will be, because the more that you delve into this, the more complicated it becomes. For example, if you were to have trusted trader status and they had a special lane on the motorway to travel through quickly, if you were to have exemptions for regular workers who cross the border every day and they had a special traffic lane, and then if you were to have small businesses exempted and they had a special traffic lane. I mean, I understand in Tijuana, Mexico-California border, there's 37 lanes of traffic. Now, just imagine the physical infrastructure that is required to have 37 lanes of traffic when, at the moment, we have two. We have one fast road that has two lanes. So how do you physically provide that infrastructure to do the checking? And that's only on the main Belfast-Dublin road. When you think of the 300 miles of border twisting through farms and houses and villages, how do you create that sort of infrastructure? So you have massive technical, logistical problems, and then massive social disruption and business disruption, because if you're transporting your milk across the border to get processed into yogurt and then brought back again for sale, if you're transporting Guinness up and down, Guinness is brewed in Dublin, of course, on the Liffey, and then canned and bottled in Belfast. Coca-Cola is generated in Ballina and County Mayo and then taken to Lisburn in the north and bottled in German steel, canned in German steel and bottled and then taken back to the south for sale. You know, just the mind boggles at those cross-border movements and the added value with each bit of the production process. Apple, somebody was telling me about apples. The tariff for the EU to bring an apple in is 3%, but if it's a dried apple, it's 7%, and if it's a stewed apple, it's 12%. So how do you have mechanisms to determine who pays what, where, when, how, when you don't have the infrastructure or the technology yet to do it?
It would appear that even if there is a sincere effort, and we have to assume that there is between the UK and Ireland, that there will have to be some kind of provision. Just listening to the complexity of what you were talking about is, varied lanes. No matter what, this is not going to be great for the stability of Northern Ireland, and it will definitely be a head scratcher for inward investment into Northern Ireland, and that can be very devastating.
And that's one of the worries, because we are a small place. We're fewer than 2 million people on the whole island, fewer than 7 million people. So we have these fantastic assets, as you know.
Yeah.
We're English-speaking, we have the rule of law and order, we are highly educated, we've got wonderful greenfield sites, wonderful attractions, creative industries, software, technology, all of those things going for us. But at the end of the day, we're a small part of the world. And if we have divisions between us on top of our political divisions, orange and green, if we have technical divisions and border divisions, that does make it more difficult to remain a player in winning investment and jobs and trade. So that's why these negotiations are so critical, so that those are allowed, and why we need some creative solutions politically and technically.
You know, the economic fundamentals are, you know, if we go back 5, 7, 10 years ago and take a look at the progress that has been made, for instance, in the CGP, grew and continues to grow in the north despite this. So one would have to either say, well, Brexit is going to happen one way or the other, and in the meantime, que sera, sera. To have the GDP, growing at a time when uncertainty seems to be the key issue, and you know, this is uncharted territory. So are you saying that that one way or the other, because of the smallness of Northern Ireland, that it's going to be okay one way or the other? There's no disaster looming here, is there?
Well, there is a bleak view that there is a disaster, and there's a naive, popular view that it'll all be great and we can trade with the rest of the world and it'll be fantastic. Now, I think both of those are artificially exaggerated.
Yeah.
There will definitely be transitional hassle. You know, just
yeah.
Work your way through this is going to take 5 or 10 years. But at the moment, because of the fall of the pound sterling, exports are much cheaper, and there's a boom in UK exports, including from Northern Ireland, and some businesses are selling brilliantly because of that. So there's one positive benefit, unexpected, unintended, not planned, but a positive benefit of the currency exchanges. This very weekend, there's a big conference in Belfast with the regional governments of China, and 300 Chinese delegates are looking at what we have here in Northern Ireland and what we can sell. And there's great interest in our pork business and our high quality of our pork trade, and there's other agri-food aspects there. Now, some people are saying, well, that will be easier after Brexit because we can negotiate the deals there more quickly and more easily without having to go through the European rules. So that is a possibility. The US ambassador to London was over in Belfast last month, and he said that Belfast and Northern Ireland would be a very attractive investment destination for American companies because we speak English, we think the same way, we have the same standards of law, and transport isn't so difficult. So there are some stars on the horizon that may come to pass. So it's not all doom and gloom, but everyone agrees it's going to be a messy, complicated road to get those shining examples of success.
Now, taking the the island of Ireland as a whole, are there some statistics that would show that the Republic, the 26 counties in Ireland, have much less to worry about?
It cuts both ways. There are some London-based companies are moving to Dublin to make sure they have it. So that is causing an influx is too strong a word, some marginal growth in headquarters being based in Dublin, which is a good thing for the Irish economy. However, so much of the Irish economy trades with Britain. So the East-West trade is massive. And so there is a fear that if there are tariff barriers between Europe, in which Ireland will be, and Britain, which will be outside it, that trade will be disrupted. A lot of the agricultural products from Ireland go straight into Britain.
Right.
And so that is a worry, because those farmers and agri-food people will have to look for other European markets to sell into without tariff barriers, rather than the British market.
Quentin Oliver, it boggles the mind to accept that there has not been, a government, an assembly in Northern Ireland since last January, at a time when it was no secret that Brexit was going to have a tremendous impact on Northern Ireland. And one has to, and I need to ask you directly, does the reform of the government in Northern Ireland, is that been kind of pushed on the back burner for the time being, or forgetting about the political ramifications and the dead-end roads that those negotiations seem to be hitting every now and again, is there resentment, and is there going to be continuing resentment in the north, regardless of how this goes, and say, well, somehow we made out all right without you, or will the parties then take blame if it doesn't go right? How can Northern Ireland, which through the peace process and having had Northern Ireland's assembly representing all of the people of the north, are people getting fed up, or is it becoming a non-issue?
We're all very fed up about it, because we recognize that we need political representation, and you can't make political decisions by technocrats and paid officials, and you can't do it by algorithm. You need human beings to be elected and to negotiate and take responsibility. There certainly is a frustration. But the bigger worry is that the draw of the motherships in each case is pulling interest away. So Sinn Féin are looking towards the Dáil in Dublin and the next Irish election, and the DUP are bound in through their supply and confidence agreement to the Conservative government in Westminster. So both have bigger fish to fry in that sense, and therefore don't have the bandwidth to get serious about the Northern Ireland negotiations. And in one sense, for some Republicans, it suits them that Northern Ireland is seen as ungovernable and as a failed political entity in their aspiration to win power in the Dáil in Dublin and then to reunite the island. So some would argue that they have no interest in getting back into government in the north. That's the polar opposite in the case of the DUP, because they really do need to get back in, because they will lose their credibility in London and lose the power of their 10 votes if they don't have power and pulling the levers of the money that they negotiated from the Conservatives, the £1 billion extra pounds for that, that if they don't have access to that back instalment, then they will lose their credibility. So it's an awkward standoff at the moment, and everyone is willing them to get back in as soon as possible to make sure that our interests are represented in these very complicated and very important negotiations over the border.
Sinn Féin will have a new leader sooner rather than actually in February. And now we have, you know, a new Taoiseach, Deputy Prime Minister in the South. Is there or are there are there those who feel that's good, or does it really, at the end of the day, are these considered to be, you know, party shifts rather than something, you know, quite useful and immediate in terms of dealing with, you know, the urgency of this? What's the story there?
Well, there was nobody really looking forward to an Irish general election before Christmas, except those who thought that Sinn Féin might suffer because Gerry Adams was still leader and that they hadn't handed over the crown to what looks likely to be Mary Lou McDonald.
Right.
But that was a fleeting irony that they would have to wait until February, and now that election won't be called before Christmas, Sinn Féin will be able to have their new leader in place, and that will be a generational shift and a shift of style and tone within Sinn Féin, everyone expects. But on the other hand, the loss of Francis Fitzgerald was because of the personal responsibility over the Garda McCabe whistleblowing case rather than a policy shift within Fine Gael, and binding in Simon Coveney to the Taoiseach position was seen as logical, since he's so critical to both the Brexit and the Northern discussions and negotiations.
Quentin, if you're a betting man, and you're not, you're an expert in solutions in conflict resolution, but do you feel that in the next 10 days a threatened walkout, or if the European Union, and if those negotiations, if that turns out to be wishy-washy, what is there anywhere to go from there?
I think they will deal. That's the good scenario, that they will do a deal, and the DUP may have to be flexible a little in terms of they don't like special status for Northern Ireland within the UK, but some special arrangements because of that land border I think will come about, and that'll be positive. If it doesn't, I think that's the question you're asking.
Yes.
It looks bleak for a while, but the key to this is that we're not in a violent mode. Violence has been all but removed. The paramilitary organisations are all but finished. And that this is being conducted from a position of argument and democratic debate, even without Stormont Assembly actually operating. So we're in gridlock and deadlock politically, but it's not hampering the expression of those views and opinions about how we want to run our affairs across the island and hopefully across the two islands in a positive way that encourages trade, movement of people, and the full and fair expression of cultural identity.
Your website, Quentin, first of all, let's end on a very positive note there, because what we hear and read is nothing but doom and and gloom, and so to have a prediction that this is for real, that this is not going to be just one more splash in the pan and then everybody goes back and has the holidays, and with the help of God it'll come up again sometime in the spring. Your company, your website, how do we get information on Stratagem and your good self?
Indeed. Our website is stratagem-ni.com, and that will lead you to our analysis of what's happening in Northern Ireland and the links internationally, and that's so important for us and for the world, and that's why programs like yours, Adrian, are an outlet to the tri-state area in and around New York and are so important. And often I get people do make contact with us because they want to follow something up or hear more about what's happening here. So I think that's mutual benefit to us and to your listeners in and around New York.
Again, as a contributor to Irish Radio Network, USA, we're always delighted to welcome you. The website is Stratagem, Stratagem, Stratagem.com?
-ni.com.
-ni.com. All right, thank you, Quentin, and you've given us a great amount of information which we wouldn't read or hear or see anywhere else. Thank you for being available to us and bringing us the real analysis of what's happening in Northern Ireland. Again, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Happy Christmas and happy holidays to you and yours. And friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA.